Succession number 28353, Reel 18.
One of the sort of the major issues which is still ongoing, which I sort of started but didn't see to fruition, is what they call the military flying training scheme, which will be a partnership with industry or a commercial partner of some sort to provide a end-to-end flying training structure for the Air Force for the future. I mean, we already contractorize the servicing support for most of our training aircraft, whether it's with Serco or Brahma or VT Aerospace, but MFTS really designed progressively over a period of time to hand over the responsibility for providing a training structure for the Royal Air Force as far as its aircrew are concerned. And I don't know quite what will come out of that. My one concern, which was always going to be difficult to stick to, was that at the end of the day, it should be seen to be a military structure, and that I have no difficulty with handing over the provision of aircraft, the servicing of aircraft, quite a lot of the administrative side of this structure to a commercial partner. But at the end of the day, I wanted young men and women who were coming into our aircrew to arrive at a unit where there was a Royal Air Force station commander, not Mr. Edwards, running a flying club of which they were a part. And I think getting that right is going to be the trick, because the degree to which people will feel that you have fully contractorized it, when actually you've got a military command chain still in place, is going to be difficult circle to square. But if we don't square that circle and we do literally hand it over to, you know, Mr. Smith running a flying club through which we put our people, then I think we will lose out hugely on ethos and professionalism and everything. And so that is going to be difficult. I just don't know how that's going to come out. But it really is, from the long-term health of the service, it is absolutely fundamental that we do get it right. Because no matter what else, we may not always have had the best aircraft in the world and the best systems in the world, but I think we have, over many years, had aircrew who are as good, if not better, at operating the systems that they've been equipped with than anybody else in the world. And we say we give that up at our peril. We've already talked about the European Air Group. Again, as CAS, I was much involved in that further sort of work to increase the number of nations involved and the number of studies and the work streams that they were doing, but nothing particular during my time, other than the setting up of an air transport coordination centre in Holland. A very good idea, really, to try and make maximum use of the assets available. So each of the European air forces have some sort of air transport force, some greater than others, obviously. And quite often that air transport force is going from A to B on a return journey, only partly full or even empty. And this coordination centre, based in Holland, is kept up to date with where air traffic assets are and whether they're full and empty. And if you want, you know, if France or Germany wants to bid against one of our aircraft which is travelling back empty to bring some stuff for them, then that goes on. And it's very good, and there's no payment, because what happens is, if I give you a C-130 sortie today, I'll expect you to give me a couple of Transaal sorties in a few weeks, and by and large, at the end of the financial year, if it's about even Stevens, then nobody worries. And that, I think, is an excellent way of using the EA group from an interoperability and coordination sense. We in UK have been fighting off a German and to a degree French aspiration to turn that coordination centre into an air transport command headquarters, which would actually have command of the assets. And we certainly in the UK were not prepared, and ministers supported us, not prepared to have that happen. But I have no doubt there'll be further pressure to do so. The other sort of body which, as chief, I got involved in a lot was something called the European Air Chiefs Committee, which is really just, again, a grouping of European air chiefs from the 26 European Union air forces who meet sort of every 6 months or so. There is an agenda. There's not a great deal decided out of it. It's more of a talking shop and the ability and an opportunity to get to know each other. So once every sort of 6 months, this would meet in one capital or another. So it was a bit of sort of European tourism as well. But very good to get to know one's opposite numbers. But not a great deal ever came out of it. A lot of bilateral visits and contacts, of course, as chief, and countries that either went to or came and saw me. I certainly visited America, India, Pakistan, China, Singapore, all the various countries in the Middle East, Portugal, Spain, Poland, Brazil, Uruguay, Chile, Argentina, Canada, France, South Africa, and Turkey. But equally there were inbound visits from countries like Japan, Russia and so forth, which I haven't already mentioned. So quite a major program of bilateral relations. I suppose the key ones in my time were America, without doubt whatsoever, because of our workings on operations together. The Middle East, particularly important to maintain good relationships there in order to sustain access to support our interests in the Middle East. I suppose Singapore, really from a point of defence exports, to try and promote national industry over there. Russia, because again we were trying to find a way to work more closely with them, and that has been difficult. We haven't found that easy, not as easy in the Air Force sense as the Navy have at sea. I think the sea as an environment offers a better opportunity for naval cooperation than the air does, and we don't seem to have made as much progress as we would have liked.
This is because of difficulties raised at their end, is it?
Yeah, more their end than our end, yes. We were very keen to try and get our tanker forces operating more closely together, and perhaps our support helicopter forces and things of that nature, but not a great deal of response and reaction from the Russians.
Why was that?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Not sure. Maybe because, you know, we'd actually have to go to Russia to operate, or they'd have to come to us. They don't have the money. They may not want us actually seeing their bases and things of that nature. Whereas at sea, a ship, you know, meets another ship at sea, you know, yes, you're talking to each other, but you're not visiting necessarily each other, you're not on each other's sovereign territory and so forth. So I think it's much easier for ships to operate together in the Russian dimension than it is perhaps for air forces to do so. Well, I certainly didn't get very far with my opposite number trying to get a greater cooperation. That obviously took a reasonable amount of time in terms of bilateral links.
Can I just ask, at the beginning of your, when you set out, when you started your discussion of your time at CAS, you mentioned you started with operations, and you haven't touched much, if at all, on no-fly zones, Desert Fox, Sierra Leone, for example, or Afghan, or the Afghan situation. I don't know whether you want to or not, but I merely mentioned that you haven't.
Not
touched.
Really. I mean, clearly, I would have been more closely involved if I had been CNC Strike at that stage, and was no fly zones were in operation on the CNC strike.
Yes.
And of course, chiefs of staff used to talk about all of those in chiefs of staff committee, but you know, I think there wasn't anything particularly unusual about them. I provided Air Force advice to the CDS of the day, on which he made decisions on how operations were to be run, but there was nothing particularly noteworthy out of those. As I said, the no-fly zones tended to sort of go in fits and starts
of activity,
with sometimes the Americans wanting to cool things down, sometimes the Americans wanting to hot things up, and so it would go, and you clearly have to try and make sure that ministers were kept in step with what we as chiefs thought was right, but equally sometimes there was a reluctance in number 10 to be quite as aggressive as the Americans wanted to be, and we had to find a way round that, particularly when the Americans were at the end of the day using our assets to target certain systems, and we had to look at rules of engagement very carefully. So there were one or two issues along those lines, but by and large those operations other than Gulf War II didn't give us great headaches.
So when you say, use the expression, use our assets, the Americans actually wanted the RAF to do certain things.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, we were operating in a coalition under American overall operational command, and therefore they would want to use our tornadoes to, say, target certain systems or command and control systems, and we would have to make sure that the targets they wanted us to go against fell within our rules of engagement. And our rules of engagement were often more demanding than American rules of engagement, which tended to be much more permissive and free than ours were. Americans are much more ready to up the ante than our politicians were.
And that would be a good thing, would it, in your view?
I think the Americans are inclined to be a little gung-ho in that respect, and not worry too much about rules of engagement. I think occasionally our ministers are too finicky and are not prepared to delegate authority. Actually, during Gulf War II, ministers were very good, but during the no-fly zone times, there were occasions when they, you know, were arguing over lines of attack and all sorts of things, which was very bureaucratic. But, you know, they're the boss at the end of the day.
Yep.
One or two sort of strands. I've talked a little bit about the working of the FPMG, or the Defence Management Group, as it then became known. I think one of the things which I had a difficulty with, and this was actually one of sort of Guthrie's views, you know, he said, you know, we as a defence management group are a collective body, like a cabinet, I suppose, and he's right in that respect, and therefore he said we must come to collective decisions. So you, must not defend your own corner, you know, you must see the bigger picture, and that's fine, and I don't have any difficulty with that. But within the defence management group, it was really only the single service chiefs who had full command responsibilities. So if you felt quite strongly about a particular issue because of the long-term health of your own service, but everybody else had decided that actually money should be given to the Navy and not you as an Air Force in extremis, or the Army, or whatever it happened to be, it was a bit hard to say, oh, well, you know, of course, you know, if everybody thinks that, well, you know, I don't mind, you know, give it. And he would not have it that the chiefs had a more difficult position in being a collective organisation than the other people round the table, like Second PUS or the Vice Chief, who was purple, obviously, and so forth. And that I found quite difficult from time to time. You know, you'd feel that you were doing something wrong in championing your own cause. Now, clearly, there's a time and a place when you actually say, well, I'm not making it here, and so there's pointless me going on, and you then accept it and say, well, we'll have to agree to disagree, and the decision has been made. But that's quite different from saying you come and having looked at the papers in advance, you don't even bother to defend your corner at all. You come along and say, of course the First Sea Lord is right, he must have the extra resources. Because if your people know that that's the way you've, because it'll get back to them, that you haven't bothered to defend your own corner, then you'll lose their support fairly quickly. I've mentioned the issue of PUS's chairmanship or non-chairmanship in many ways of the FPMG. That's Tebbit's.
Tebbit, yes.
Equally, the Chiefs of Staff Committee, chaired by the CDS, that was almost sidelined by the PUS. Tebbit very rarely bothered to attend Chiefs of Staff meetings, although he should have done. He would sort of turn up half an hour and disappear, or not turn up and come in for the last half an hour. He really didn't give the Chiefs of Staff Committee nearly the respect that it ought to have had, and that used to frustrate the CDS, Mike Boyce of the day, and I felt that it was a poor reflection on the priority that he gave to business because there are certain things which are actually either totally out with the balance of investment and therefore the Defence Management Group. In other words, these are issues that ought to be debated within a Chiefs of Staff environment, but he ought to be there, or they go through one committee to the other, because chiefs get their mind around something before it goes to the PUS chair, because there are resource implications. Now, if it's because he knows that the issue is coming on to the FPMG in due course, well, you might understand that. But if it's an issue which isn't coming on to him, then, as I say, I don't think his attendance record at the Chiefs of Staff Committee was anything like as good as it should have been. I think the other thing which became a bit frustrating, because actually it started quite well, was after a while, Hoon sort of stopped having Defence Council meetings. I don't know whether he just didn't see any value in them. That was him meeting with the CDS and with the Chiefs of Staff and the PUS, second PUS and so forth. Whether he felt they weren't useful or not, I don't know, but he really stopped. So months and months and months would go by without a Defence Council meeting, and that, I think, to the Chiefs was a bit frustrating, because again it was an opportunity for them to get views in front of the Secretary of State, whereas on a day-to-day basis the people who got most time with him were the CDS and the PUS, who would therefore tend to to condition his decision making from regular contact, whereas the Chiefs didn't get in to see him as much as perhaps they should have done. However, that said, the one thing that Hume was quite good at is once a year he would attend a service board. So each of the single services who had monthly board meetings, at least once a year, if not twice a year, he would attend one of those board meetings. And therefore, to that extent, he had a chance to hear the single service dimension. And I suppose, therefore, of the two, if he was going to do one or the other, then maybe that was more important. But equally, I would like to have seen him do a few more defence cuts. And he did start doing that, but say whether he decided that they weren't important or whether he just didn't have the time or not, I don't know. And I think just one of the last things is to just explain my philosophy towards appointing my successor. I wasn't selected to be the CDS, and I'm not in any way bitter about that. I think if I was looking at myself and Mike Walker as the two potential candidates, I think I would have gone for Walker myself. I don't go into the reasons, but I think I would certainly have tended to vote that way. So I was not disappointed at all not to be CDS, but it did seem to me that it was very important to put in place a successor who was going to compete strongly for that job. Lord Craig was the last CDS that we had sort of in 91 time, so it was now sort of 15 years or nearly 15 years later. I'm sure if John Thompson had lived to be CAS, he would have been CDS, but fate intervene, so he wasn't. So it really was time that we competed strongly for that. I looked at the talent that I had available, and really it was either John Day, who was CNC Strike Command, or Stirrup, who was at that stage a Deputy Chief of Defence Staff in the centre in MOD, but having been a group commander and held a number of other high-ranking appointments, and I decided that that Stirrup offered the best opportunity for someone who would command the Air Force well, which was important. It was no good finding somebody who was a good CDS candidate but would actually not command the Air Force well. I felt that he would do that probably equally well to John Day. I think John Day would have been a good CAS, but was not, I don't think, going to compete as well for the CDS job when that became available. He was more equivalent to my age, so he would have been necessarily a little bit older, which is no bad thing, but I don't think that he has the brain and the intellect that Stirrup does. And so I selected and recommended Stirrup, which surprised some because of the leapfrogging that was required. But my recommendation was accepted by the CDS, by PUS, and by the Secretary of State. And so Stirrup was put in post. It hadn't, my selection had nothing whatsoever. I mean, there was perhaps a feeling that it was something to do with Mullough-Kintyre, and because of the controversy over Mullough-Kintyre and so forth, I didn't want to put Day in for the bid, but it had nothing to do with that whatsoever. And of course, as hindsight has turned out, Stirrup has now been selected to be CDS, takes over in May 2006, and so to that extent, I'm delighted. And I think that's all I've got to tell you.
Well, thank you very much. Before we finish, you've given me just a couple of questions. You've given me very good sketches of the CDSs you had and the PUS and two Secretary of States at various times that you came into contact with. But you haven't said very much about your fellow chiefs.
Okay. Well, I...
That you were with...
Yeah. During my time as CAS, General Mike Walker was the CGS for most of it, although he was replaced by Mike Jackson for about the last 6 or 7 months of my time as CAS. Mike Boyce was the first Sea Lord. When he became CDS, Nigel Essenhigh was the first Sea Lord. And he was followed by Alan West, because Essenhigh only did a relatively short tour of just under 2 years through his own sort of volition. I really got on with all of them pretty well, but I think the Walker Essenhigh Squire team was a strong team. I enjoyed, as I said, working for Boyce and therefore working with him when he was chief, but that was only for a while. So the main core of the team was Walker, Essenhigh and myself, and not only did the three of us as men get on, but our wives got on very well and still do. So that was quite a strong team. It's funny how you sort of, you know, when you know you're sort of coming towards the end and someone else gets, you perhaps don't get to know them as well as the team user. So I didn't get to know Jackson as well. And Alan West, I don't think he and I would have got on as well as I got on with Essenhigh. Alan West has his own very clear agenda. He likes to play the theatre a little bit, and that's not so much my style. So I think I would have found it a bit more difficult to have had quite the same relationship with him as I had with Nigel Essenhigh. I think the core team, whilst I was chief, got on very well. Of course, we didn't always agree with one another or the priorities allocated, but we never fell out.
and I must come back to something. I can't let you off the hook. You said that General Walker would have made a better CDS than yourself, but you were cautious about the reasons. And
no, I didn't say he would make a...
Sorry.
Well, what I said is that I think I would have selected him. If I'd been a total outsider, I think I would have selected him rather than myself.
Yes. Does that therefore not mean that he might have made a better...
I think
yes,
he,
than yourself or not? Am I...
Well, it is difficult, and you've asked me a sort of difficult sort of question, but I think if I were looking at the two of us, I would think that perhaps he would have the image and gravitas and so forth of a CDS. You know, he's a big man and so forth. I think the army go about grooming their senior people in a different way than we have done, and I'm not quite sure how we get over that, but I don't think we necessarily groom our people for that job as well as the army do, or indeed perhaps as well as the navy do. Where if you say, for example, the army mafia, for want of a better word, is far better integrated into the state sort of organs than the Air Force is. I mean, they are deeply involved with the royal family. They are deeply involved in the Lord Lieutenancy of this country. All of those aspects, they have got their roots deeply embedded in those particular parts of our national infrastructure. They're retired chiefs, retired CGSs and retired CDSs take a very active interest in talking to people, promoting their man, getting him introduced, seen about, and so forth. The Air Force, in my view, has never done that. We're not integrated particularly closely in the royal family. There are some contacts, but nothing like the military and naval contacts in that respect. Because, I mean, for example, you know, when do you see a member of the royal family wearing Royal Air Force uniform? Very, very rarely. I managed to persuade the Prince of Wales to wear Air Force uniform in my last year as CAS at Remembrance Sunday at the Cenotaph. It took me sort of 18 months to manage to persuade him to do that. Otherwise, as always, there would have been four royals in naval uniform and not an Air Force uniform anywhere in sight. We don't have the same sort of contacts in the shires and so forth that the army have. And so I think they do. They go about breeding their senior commanders in a way which we haven't. Whether that's wrong, I know Mike Graydon felt that we weren't doing enough, but I don't think he was ever able to change it at all. But and so I think, you know, Mike Walker had been prepared for a CDS appointment far more than I had been. If I had any claim at all, it was because I was who I was and I'd done it myself. But no one had sort of taken me by the hand, as it were, and led me round the organisation and said, now, this is somebody you need to sort of get to know, you need, and invite... I mean, let's take, for example, just a specific... Guthrie, before he retired as CDS, took Walker to Chequers to meet the Prime Minister, to have dinner and things of that nature, and showed him off, and presumably then afterwards said, well, this is the chap we really need. Nobody ever suggested that I might go to Chequers or something of that nature, because my predecessors never ever thought it was the right thing to do, or never had the confidence or whatever to do so. So I think the army pay far more attention to preparing their people, getting them the visibility and things of that nature. And therefore, I think if you were a prime minister or whatever, and you would have met Mike Walker a number of times through Field Marshal Bramall or whoever, making the connection. But that has never happened in my service.
Unusual, really, in one sense, because the RAF has this enormous legacy from the war in people's minds, rather in the way that Nelson's Navy has this... people have an idea of what the Navy is going back to Nelson.
Mm.
And it's unusual in a way that the RAF hasn't been able to capitalise on that in some way.
I think the Royal Air Force was always regarded as the grammar school boys and not the public school boys. Whereas the Army and the Navy, their officers have always been the public school boys. I mean, I know that's a caricature, it's not true throughout, but that's the way they've been regarded, whereas the Air Force was always regarded as the grammar school boys. I think it's fair to say that we have been an out-and-out meritocracy. People have got, by some part, people have got to the top purely on merit and nothing to do with the family background or that. I'm not necessarily sure that that's true in the other two services. I think people have got to the top in the other two services through connections and so forth. And they've been good people, I'm sure, but I'm not sure they've necessarily...